Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the video program and performances at Santa Fe Complex this weekend, Manipulated Image. And we're going to be speaking to Sharon Gooley about how Victorian women got dressed in 1886. I'm very happy now to welcome Lynn Olson. She's a journalist. She was Moscow correspondent for the Associated Press and White House correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. And she's author of the new book, Citizens of London: The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. And she will be speaking here in Santa Fe on Tuesday, March 16th at 4 o'clock in the Great Hall of St. John's College, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So this is a book about the alliance between the United States and Great Britain against Hitler and the Americans who went to England in 1941 to help forge this alliance. We now take for granted that the alliance between the U.S. and Britain is a very strong alliance, but what was that relationship like in 1941?
You're absolutely right. I mean, there's conventional wisdom that the creation of that alliance was almost preordained, you know, that Winston Churchill and the British would stand alone against Hitler in 1940 and 1941. Britain was the last country to hold out against Hitler, and that they would hold out just long enough so that Franklin Roosevelt and the American people could come riding to their rescue. But in fact, it wasn't clear the alliance was ever going to be created at all. You know, throughout most of that period, 40 and 41, the British were really holding on by the skin of their teeth. They were really close to being defeated by Germany, desperately needed American aid to survive. But there was really very little of that aid until Pearl Harbor, until December, after Pearl Harbor, till well into 1942.
So Hitler, of course, was mowing over one country after another in Europe. To what extent was Britain under attack? To what extent were people already suffering and dying?
Hitler had, as you said, had invaded and really conquered virtually every other country in Europe, and he turned his sights to England in the spring and summer and fall of 1941, launching bombing raids, German bombing raids against London and other major British cities. So by early 1941, tens of thousands of British civilians had already been killed in raids that. Just came and came and came. There was no let up until the spring of 1941. So lots of people had died. The British were very close to starvation at that point because German submarines had basically were very close to strangling British supply lines. So it was a really, really dark period for Britain at that point.
Meanwhile, the United States was at least partly in kind of an isolationist phase, like, hey, this isn't affecting us, so we're not going to get involved. At least some people felt that way. What was the atmosphere in the U.S. like?
Well, you described it really well. That's exactly what was going on. You know, we were 3,000 miles away from the war. We had two oceans to protect us on either side. So there was this feeling that, you know, we really didn't have to get involved, at least right now. There was also quite a bit of anti-British feeling in America at that point. You know, also American industry wasn't really all that interested in helping the British out. So there was really a sense of apathy, that was really prevalent throughout a large part of the American population at that point. Franklin Roosevelt, the president, very much wanted to help the British, and he did, in fact, but he was also very cautious. He was very wary of this strong isolationist movement in the country, and he didn't want to get too far ahead of public opinion. So he would take a couple of steps forward and then take a step back in terms of helping England.
What was Roosevelt's relationship like with Churchill? What was the political set of relations between the two countries?
At that point, in 1940 and 1941, that famous friendship that occurred between Roosevelt and Churchill was nowhere on the horizon. That was going to come later in the war. Actually, at that point, they were very skeptical, even suspicious of each other. They had met once in 1918, but Churchill didn't remember that. And they really had not had that much of a relationship. They had exchanged notes and cables with each other, but they didn't know each other. And they had been told uncomplimentary things about the other. So it was not a close relationship, to put it mildly, at that point.
Your book covers the roles of three men, John Gilbert Wynant, Averill Harriman, and Edward R. Murrow. Let's talk about each one of them. Who was Wynant? What was his role?
John Gilbert Wynant is probably the least known of the three men that I write about in this book, but he is the most significant, I think. He was the American ambassador to Britain during the entire war. He replaced Joseph Kennedy as ambassador, which was not a hard thing to do. Joseph Kennedy was very appeasement-minded. He thought Britain was going to be defeated. So when Gil Wynant arrived in England, he had a really, really tough job to convince the British that America actually was going to stand with them.
Because his predecessor had not been strong in that way.
Well, he had not only not been strong, he had been very, very outspoken in saying he thought Britain was going to be defeated and that American aid should not be given to them. So the British were not fond of him, to put it very mildly, and he had really poisoned the relationship, had helped poison the relationship between Britain and the United States. So when Wynant arrived, his job was to repair that relationship, which he did brilliantly.
Now, he was chosen very specifically for that role.
Yes, he was. He was a former governor of New Hampshire, a liberal Republican who had made it his life's work to promote social reform, to help people. I mean, his whole reason for being was to make life better for the common man. And Franklin Roosevelt, spotted him early on and was quite close to him. And when he obviously needed to replace Joseph Kennedy, he thought Wynant would be the perfect person to send over to Britain and to show the British that America really did care about them.
So how did he go about doing that?
He did it right from the beginning. The moment he stepped off his plane, and it was in March 1941, which was really the worst time of the war for Britain, the first thing he said was, "There's no place I'd rather be at this time than in England." And he really meant it. I mean, within a couple of weeks, when the bombs were still falling, there were still vicious German raids, he would walk the streets of London during those raids. And every person that he encountered, he would ask what he could do to help. This was not a public relations gimmick. He really, really meant it. And within days, the news of what he was doing just kind of spread around Britain. For a lot of the British, that compassion, that caring, that determination that he had to stand with the British and to share their dangers was the first tangible sign they had that America really did care what happened to them and their country. I mean, he showed them the best side of America, and they loved him for it.
Now, as you write, he had really unprecedented, and really, even since then, there's been nothing like it, access to British government at the highest levels.
Absolutely. Actually, all three of these men did. Averill Harriman, who was in charge of lend-lease aid for Britain. He was this hard-charging American businessman who was sent over by Roosevelt. And Edward R. Murrow, who was the famous CBS newsman in London. All three of them had incredibly close access to Churchill, because Churchill knew how important they were for the survival of Britain, and he courted them as relentlessly as he would later court Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, he gave them tremendous access, particularly Wynant and Harriman, to himself and to members of his government. I mean, he basically made them members of his official family, and he also, which this is even more interesting, at least to me, he brought them into his own family life, his own personal family life. Winant and Harriman, for example, spent almost every weekend with the Churchills, you know, in the country. I mean, diplomacy has never been quite as personal as it was during this time. In fact, they were so close to the Churchills that all three of them were romantically involved with members of Churchill's family, which is an extraordinary thing.
It does go to show not just the romantic part, but the way in which international relations are really shaped by personal relationships, by spending time together, by liking each other, things like that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in this case, I'm not sure I've ever seen an example of where that was true as much as with the Anglo-American Alliance, especially in London with Americans. It really was important, not only with Churchill and these three men, but with officials from both countries. Other officials from both countries. It was really extremely important.
We're talking to Lynn Olson, author of the book Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. So we have an ambassador, an industrialist, and a journalist. Let's talk about the industrialist, Averell Harriman. Who was he, and why was he chosen for this very important role?
Averell Harriman was the son of the railroad tycoon E.H. Harriman, who was one of the great robber barons of the 19th century, early 20th century in the U.S. He actually took over from his father after his father died. He was chairman of Union Pacific Railroad. He was desperate to become somebody important in the Roosevelt administration, but until he was given this job in 1941, FDR had very little to do with him, but he in fact did give him this very, very important job, which was to oversee American aid to Britain. And Harriman picked up the ball and ran with it. I mean, he was very anxious to become an important member of the Roosevelt administration, and in fact he did by really creating a role that. That really wasn't there. I mean, he was supposed to just be in charge of aid, but he kind of horned in on Winant's turf, if you will, and took a fair amount of his duties away from him. He also became extremely close to Winston Churchill, and in doing that, kind of improved his position with Roosevelt as well. So he very much used this Lend-Lease job to become something that he had not been, which was a key player in the U.S. government.
There was the very important role that all three of these men had was to form this alliance between the United States and Britain, and basically to save Britain from Hitler. So that was their job. Meanwhile, Harriman had quite a large share of personal ambition. Were those things at odds with each other in any way?
No, not at all. I mean, he used his position in London as Lend-Lease aid administrator, and then he broadened that position to further his personal ambition. He was brilliant at doing it. I mean, he managed to carve out, for example, a role as kind of the buffer, the conduit, the mediator between Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, which certainly was not in his job description as head of Lend-Lease aid. And he used that that role that he had managed to carve out to become, at the end of the war, one of the one of the top diplomats that in the State Department. A number of presidents after Roosevelt, from Truman to Kennedy to Johnson, used him as a troubleshooter and sent him around the world. So he managed to succeed in what he set out to do in a very big way.
The third man in this group whom you write about is Edward R. Murrow. He was already there. He was already a longtime broadcast journalist living in England.
That's absolutely right. He came in 1937 as not as a journalist, actually, for CBS, but as something called the director of talks. in Europe for CBS. He wasn't even a journalist. He had not had one day of journalistic experience in his life at that point. And he was just there to arrange lectures and other broadcasts for CBS. But he saw what was happening in Europe, that war was about to break out. And he basically trained himself to become a journalist. And from 1937 on, actually 1938 on, he was on the air as a journalist, and hired a number of other correspondents to work with him as a team. And really, these guys made broadcast journalism the number one way that most Americans got their news by the end of the war. I mean, he had started as a complete non-entity, and by the end of the war, by 1945, he was probably the most influential journalist and certainly the best-known journalist in America.
What did he do that was so distinctive and so influential?
He made it very clear to the American people that this European war affected them. His reporting, particularly from London during the Blitz and the Battle of Britain, during the night after night of German bombing raids, had a big influence on American public opinion. He was a real master at reporting what was happening. I mean, he was a master at putting his listeners into the shoes of those who were affected by, for example, the bombing. He made his listeners see what was going on. He was an extraordinary master at being able to describe in very vivid, minute detail what he saw. And this did have a big impact on Americans back home. I won't say he was largely responsible, but he played a large role in changing American public opinion from thinking, well, we really don't have anything, we don't want anything to do with what's going over there, to the idea that maybe, in fact, we need to help Britain, not only because it's a moral responsibility, which he thought it was, but because if we don't, we're going to find ourselves in the same boat that they are. So his role was critically important in that change in American public opinion that did finally occur.
And he had a natural and longstanding appreciation for the underdog and was always trying to basically elevate the most downtrodden people through his work, through his journalism.
Absolutely. He was a big idealist and always had been. He's a fascinating man because he both enjoyed hobnobbing with the rich and the famous and the aristocratic people in England, in London. But he also, as you said, had a deep feeling for the common man, and he saw very clearly the need for reform and for a better world after the war. He kept dwelling on that in his broadcast throughout the war.
So, you start out in 1941. Over the course of the next few years, how did their work develop, and what happened? Tell us a little bit about that whole narrative.
Okay. From the time that, Harriman and Winant arrived in 1941, and Murrow was doing this even before, their big objective, or one of their big objectives, was to make it clear to the American government and the American people how important it was to not only send considerably more aid to the British, but also to get into the war. That basically was the bottom line for all three of them. They saw how very important it was that America be part of an alliance with England, with Britain. And once Pearl Harbor happened on December 7th, 1941, that part of their fight was over. By the way, I should mention that the whereabouts of these three men on that night, on December 7th, show very clearly their importance in this struggle. Winant and Harriman were with Churchill at Chequers, the Prime Minister's country estate, that night, and Murrow was with Roosevelt at the White House. And when they heard about Pearl Harbor, all three of them knew that part of the fight was over. But a new fight was just beginning, which is really the struggle to create, I mean, to keep this new alliance going. And it was not an easy thing to do, to put it mildly. You know, it as we look at it now, the Anglo-American Alliance was the special relationship. You know, it was the alliance that helped save the war and save democracy. But and that is all true. But when it began, it wasn't clear that it was going to end up as smoothly as it did.
How did British public opinion change, and how were these three men active in that set of changes?
Well, there was considerable misunderstanding and considerable lack of knowledge on the part of both Americans and British about each other. You know, we have a common language with the British. We have a common heritage. We have a common love of freedom. But there wasn't a lot of knowledge about the other's history and the other's political and military situations. So these three men, in their own ways, helped educate and helped smooth the way on both sides. For example, Murrow did a lot of broadcasting back to his American listeners and told them, tried to educate them about the British, you know, on very simple terms, what the British were like. But he also did it for the British. I mean, he would go on the BBC and talk about Americans and how similar or how dissimilar they were to the British. So he always thought of himself as an educator, and that's what he did throughout the war. Harriman and Wynant both served as mediators between Churchill and Roosevelt and other members of the American and British governments. You know, as I said, they tried to get rid of problems. They smoothed the relationships. Wynant also played a big role in educating the British public about Americans. He was a teacher to begin with. I mean, he started out his career as a teacher, high school teacher. And so he also considered himself an educator and played a very, very important role in doing that. He also helped educate American troops who landed in Britain in 1943 and 1944 to prepare for D-Day. He educated them about their British hosts, about the British people. So, you know, a lot of this was behind-the-scenes kind of stuff, but it was really vital to, you know, for the success of this alliance.
I have to say, I had also never heard of Wynant, and I guess he's the least known of these three. Mm-hmm. Why has he not been as well remembered?
You know, I think there's a lot of reasons. He was quiet, he was shy, he was unassuming. He did not like the spotlight. He much preferred to work behind the scenes, whereas these other men, Murrow obviously was not behind the scenes. He was out there every day broadcasting. And Harriman never wanted to be behind the scenes. He always wanted to be in the center of action, and wanted everybody to know it. But Wynant wasn't like that. I also think he died very early. He died just a year and a half after the war. He killed himself, as a matter of fact. And I think that his suicide, his death, has meant that a lot of people had no idea, you know, who he was or what he did. Which I think is really a tragedy, because he did contribute so much to the success of this alliance. And, you know, I think he deserves a lot of credit. And actually, one reason I wrote the book is to hopefully give him the credit.
So at the end of the war, the U.S. was beloved by all. And what happened in the decades that followed? I mean, you write about how Europe, at a certain point, got tired of America's insistence on their leadership in everything.
Right. Well, I would just say that when the war ended, it ended obviously well for the Allies because we won. But the U.S. wasn't totally beloved by all. I mean, they had made very clear toward the end of the war. We had made very clear toward the end of the war that we were going to run the peace basically as we had run the war. I mean, we were the strongest, the richest, the most powerful ally of the Western Alliance, and we were going to do the same with the peace. So there was much less sense of partnership right after the war than there had been during the war, and the British particularly felt that. They didn't like it, but they certainly felt it. So there was, you know, some tension among the Allies at the end of the war, and the Europeans certainly, the British and the other Europeans certainly did not like the fact that the Americans were basically telling them what to do. But of all the Allies, the British still remained the closest to the United States, you know, from that time until now. But there was always the hope that they were going to be more equal than they turned out to be, that partnership would be an equal partnership. But it never has been. The U.S. has always taken the lead in that partnership.
Well, it's a fascinating story. Lynn Olson is a journalist. She's the author of the new book, Citizens of London, The Americans Who Stood with Britain in Its Darkest, Finest Hour. And once again, she will be speaking on Tuesday, the 16th of March at 4 o'clock in the Great Hall of St. John's College here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Council on International Relations. For more information, people can go to sfcir.org or call 505-982-4931. Lynn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm happy now to welcome Elise Stepanian. She is a video artist, and she is the curator of Manipulated Image, which we're about to talk about. It's an event happening this weekend at Santa Fe Complex. Anthony Buchanan is here. He's an experimental film and media artist, and Ian Anderson is a writer and performance artist. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So this is the first anniversary celebration of the Manipulated Image series. I guess this is number 11, and it's tomorrow, Friday, March 12th at 6:30. It's called For Action's Sake. Tell us, first of all, about the Manipulated Image series.
Manipulated Image is a series I started a year ago. It's a series of screenings of experimental short videos by artists from all around the world, U.S. local artists. I started it because I'm a video artist, and when I moved to Santa Fe less than 3 years ago, I felt like there was a need for a venue to show that kind of work. These short videos could be also referred to as art videos. They're different than the traditional kind of videos where there's a need for narration, beginning, middle, and end. Doesn't mean that the videos I show are not narrative. That's not necessarily so. But the people whose work I show, they normally refer to themselves as artists rather than filmmakers.
And so this set of videos is in a program called For Action's Sake. Now, this is referring to political action.
Well, not necessarily political action. The idea behind For Action's Sake is it refers to fetishizing the idea of action taking. It could be political, it could be religious, it could be, well, I guess everything, if you look at it that way, everything could be political. For example, rebellion for the sake of rebellion, racism for the sake of racism, following religious ideology for the sake of just doing it without questioning it. So basically it's about people having preconceived notions about socially constructed values or realities and not questioning them. And then the other part of it is, For Action's Sake is a play on word referring to art for art's sake. In 19th century, artists tried to separate themselves from the society, stating that art doesn't have to have moral justification, doesn't have to be about patriotism or devotion, or, you know, we don't have to make historical paintings or paintings representing the bourgeoisie. Art could, in fact, be irreverent, could be subversive, and it doesn't need to have any moral justification. So what happened was that art became a little bit difficult to understand for the everyday person. It became very abstract. But then there were the avant-garde artists, the progressive modernists. The avant-garde artists were the modernists. The progressive modernists they actually became rebellious against the conservative values of the society. And sometimes they even had antagonistic attitude towards the society.
But meanwhile, they weren't doing arts just for art's sake either.
Right, right. But at the end, the critics of modernism have said that these artists that were criticizing these conservative values of the society at the end, they became co-opted by the system that they were criticizing. Because, for example, an abstract painting was hung in the living room of the bourgeoisie, or the art that was supposed to be rebellious, it became museumified.
Right. And needed a wall that only a very wealthy person with a huge living room could put it on.
It became very elite. It became very separated from the society that it meant to, you could say in a way, it wanted to protect the society by critiquing it, by showing the ills of the society.
So let's talk to the two artists here at the table, Anthony and Ian. So you were pulled into this set of performances. What is your relationship to this topic, for action's sake, Anthony?
Well, manipulated image is something that I've been following from its genesis. About a year ago, I came to town around the same time that Elise did to attend the College of Santa Fe, and became very distraught early on when I realized that there was very little performance in experimental film, as well as more transgressive uses of emerging interactive technologies in town. There were a couple people, such as David Stout, who recently left the College of Santa Fe, and now we're starting to see a resurgence of interest in this kind of work, which I think is very needed here. The currents, people like Frank Regano, are going to be having a big exhibition coinciding with the biennial at SITE in 2010, and in June, I believe. I'm going to be starting my own lecture series at the Santa Fe complex called Cinema Unbound, which is dedicated to bringing more sort of historical sorts of experimental filmmakers and video artists in town, as opposed to a lot of the just contemporary stuff. There will be some contemporary filmmakers as well. But manipulated image has been a very, it's fueled me to get going in the community myself, because I've always wanted to see something similar to this in town. And now that something like this has really happened, I think it's going to be a real inspiration for young media artists who were kind of distraught with the closing of the College of Santa Fe, which of course now abolished all possibilities of artists to work with in that way. Working in film and video outside the mainstream Hollywood
oriented. Oh, they're not teaching that or having that happen anymore.
Absolutely not, and they're not going to be doing it in the near future anyway.
Oh, boy.
That's completely gone. And so there's lots of these little sort of David Stout-like devotees who are just kind of drifting around town now, and this presents a major opportunity, and it also really, like Elise said, it's very much needed in this community. We're so known for our forms of commercial Indian art, and we're becoming more and more known for our music venues, which is what 90% of feels like the artists in this town are engaged in. And I do believe that people who really have a passion for this stuff will come to the realization that it does take a village to preserve this kind of work and keep this kind of work going on the transgressive and cutting edge side. And something like manipulated image seems the perfect venue, the most accessible. In terms of the fact that it is sort of cut off from the more kind of elitist gallery side of things. And it's a very welcoming environment. I jumped on board with it because Elise and her partner, Philip Mantione, have been close friends of mine for a long time. I've been associated with them at the complex for a long time. And they're very, like I said, they're very open in terms of what the kind of work that they welcome. They don't have strict guidelines in terms of narrative or technology used. And it's a place, I think, where over time people will really be able to come and make things happen in this town with this kind of media.
Ian Anderson, tell us about your work and your participation in Manipulated Image.
Well, I guess you could say I was commissioned, I guess, for this little performance here. It seemed as if my reputation had preceded me, which is interesting, because I feel as if I'm just sort of getting started in this entire world of performance art and exhibition. Personally, I feel that what I do links in with what Elise and Anthony were saying about the bourgeois aspects of art, in that for me, performance art is not necessarily about the artifact itself. As a matter of fact, I would say it's one of the few acts of art creation that does not present an artifact explicitly. I would say that for me personally, it is a sort of reaction against that bourgeoisie aspect of having the painting in that multi-million dollar living room, you know, that we hypothetically mentioned, where rather than hanging me on the wall, you have a chance to come out and see me do something one night and one night only. It is a temporary and passing thing, which falls in line quite a bit with my philosophy for life and work in general, in that it is all transient and temporary, and to make an attempt to make an artifact out of life is in itself self-defeating, because while you are looking for this tangible thing that will outlast you, you're missing out all the best things, for example.
Although, what's wrong with making a photograph that captures some essential feature of...
And that's a fabulous and absolutely legitimate aspect of art making itself. The main problem I have with that is it seems to reinforce the idea of the author or the artist, capital A artist, as a sort of agent of decision. The frame is explicitly chosen by the photographer or by the illustrator to be viewed that way and that way only. Whereas with performance, I like to think that I am giving audience members a chance to get up and take in different and multiple perspectives all within the same artwork, which...
You mean if they get up and walk around?
They get up and walk around, or they could... it could be even as simple as choosing not to view the piece. I've had that happen a couple of times, and I always found that to be an interesting choice, because it is still a reaction against the artwork and a critique of it. It's, to me, much better than that mediocre reaction of, oh, well, I guess that was okay. There's nothing more bland to me than, oh, well, I guess that was okay.
I've got a question for all of you, which is with great respect to what you're doing, does anyone outside of art and academic theory circles even use the word bourgeoisie anymore? I mean, it sounds like a kind of super old-fashioned 19th century...
My family, I come from a family of labor organizers, so bourgeoisie is a sort of a playful little insult that we pass around at each other at the dinner table, you know. Oh, that's so bourgeois of you, et cetera, et cetera. In my experience, no, it's not that often used seriously outside of academic and artistic circles. It is taken more to be a bland and unquestioned fact of reality rather than an aspect that can be changed and meddled with as necessary.
This event that's coming up tomorrow night, Manipulated Image, is part of the series. It's the first anniversary of the Manipulated Image series at Santa Fe Complex. There's a lot of different things going on. There's 15 video artists from 10 different countries. There's online performances from Germany, from Sweden. There's 12 local artists performing. What are some of the themes that are coming up, Elise, in this work that you've curated?
For example, let's say the Swedish artist Jonas Nilsson. His videos are very kind of sarcastic, ironic videos in which he performs himself. They're about self-centered people in a consumer society that are just basically... very interested in themselves and nothing outside themselves.
Now, let me ask you a question, because, again, it gets into the sort of critique of the bourgeoisie kind of thing. That's this has been done. People have been critiquing consumer society for many, many decades. What's the point at this moment in history? People are going to go to Santa Fe Complex and say, why, that's me. I think I'll change my ways. I mean, what's the intention here?
Well, it's very fascinating to me that the... First of all, that this piece, or that this show is curated under the title For Action's Sake, makes it kind of ironic because all of my work involves deconstructing and actually destroying the materials of my process at the end. So I work very much with the ephemerality of these things, so it's almost anti-action. But, I mean, the bourgeois element is something that's always, unfortunately, going to be linked to video art and experimental film. It's a genre that's grown out of abstract expressionism. And the praisings of people like Clement Greenberg and early critics early on who said that the only true art is about its own making and it's about the surface and nothing else, subject matter doesn't matter, which of course everything from feminism to all political art following that in the 60s called that the most bourgeois, ridiculous, self-centered form of art. So, I mean, I just admire the fact that that a show about video art, which is synonymous with all the kinds of inaccessible, avant-garde, high modernist stuff is subverting that historical dogma.
I would say, personally, for me, it goes back to a quote from Robert Anton Wilson, the author of the Illuminatus trilogy and a number of other things. I was watching a documentary on him, and he was talking about his involvement in the hippie movement of the 60s and 70s. And he was talking about how there was a sort of unspoken feeling that a friend of his once spoke to him about. And he said that what it was about wasn't necessarily about changing the whole thing, but by rather changing one's individual perspective, whereby saying instead of it's us versus them because they have the power, it turns into we have the power, so it is just us. I would say that that's... an aspect of my performance art and art in general that I try to incorporate as often as possible.
Elise Stepanian is video artist and curator of the Manipulated Image series. Anthony Buchanan is an experimental film and media artist. And Ian Anderson is a writer and performance artist. And all of them will be part of this first anniversary celebration at Santa Fe Complex of Manipulated Image. It's called For Action's Sake. It's at 6:30. For more information, sfcomplex.org. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
I'm very happy now to welcome Sharon Gooley. She is a historic reenactor, and she will be at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium this coming Sunday, the 14th of March at 2 o'clock, doing a presentation called Victorian Dressing from the Inside Out. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So you actually reenact how Victorian women got dressed in the morning? Is that what we're going to see?
The program that I'm planning to do this Sunday is actually going to demonstrate how a Victorian woman might have dressed to go to a dinner party in 1886.
And so how many layers go into putting on this outfit to go to a party?
Oh, goodness. Just the underwear alone usually consists of 7 or 8 layers of undergarments, all of which I will demonstrate in the program. I will begin in a chemise and drawers, which is the bottommost layer, so to speak, and I keep putting layers on after that. So there's usually 7 to 8 layers of underwear, and then there's another 2 to 4 layers of the dress itself, and we have to top everything off with the correct accessories.
Why did they have to put so many things on? What was the function of each of these various layers?
Well, think about, I always try to put things in a modern perspective. Why do you choose to wear the exact clothing that you wear? There's a certain amount of clothing that a woman wears nowadays to be considered proper and decent or fashionable. What she would wear to go to the beach is far different than what she would wear if she were dressing to go out to a fancy dinner party to celebrate an event. And so a woman in 1886, a fashionable woman of high enough society who's going to a dinner party, would need to have her silhouette be fashionable. She would not want to be considered unfashionable. And in 1886, for example, the bustled silhouette was fashionable, so she would need to include a bustle, or a tournure, more commonly known back then, more properly known, I should say. She would need to include a bustle as part of her outfit, because without the bustle in 1886, she would have been horribly out of style. So in addition to the usual petticoats and corset and chemise, for example, she needs to include other pieces to look fashionable.
So basically, having an hourglass figure with a cord, little tiny waist that's corseted, and then a big, huge rear end was considered a sign of feminine beauty.
It was considered a sign of feminine beauty. It was considered by some to be what would signify the higher class from the working class. Some people considered working class women would be thick-waisted and poor, but that's not necessarily true when you do your research. There were corsets specifically designed for working class women, and they wanted to look fashionable too.
So when women dress like this, could they walk around comfortably? Could they breathe? Could they, in a pinch, run from point A to point B?
My firm belief is women are women, and we always figure out what we need to do. And being a person who dresses this way as part of the way that I earn my living, what I do, I teach Victorian balls, I do Victorian clothing programs, so I dress in this clothing on a regular basis. And what I like to tell people is, just like now, you would decide how high of a heel you want to wear, how short your skirt is, how tight your jeans are. A woman back then would have also decided how extreme her clothing would be, how tightly she would lace her corset, for example. And I have found that when I'm dressed this way, I can do everything except maybe eat a full meal. I can dance, I can run, I can bend over and pick things up off the floor. Although if I were extremely tightly corseted, it would make these things less comfortable. But you bet, if the place were on fire, every corseted woman in the place would get out the door in time.
But the steak and potatoes dinner won't fit.
I had a friend who said the only thing that she couldn't do when she was tightly corseted was eat the full meal, and she certainly would avoid the carbonated beverages.
All right. Now, how did you find these clothes? Are you using actual period artifact clothes?
Rarely in my programs do I use vintage clothing for a number of reasons. Many vintage clothing items are very fragile. Many times they're not my size. I consider them works of art that I would not want anything to happen to with the normal wear and tear on the road. So most of the outfits that I use in my programs are newly made pieces, but as often as possible, I will refer back to original patterns, books that have drafted patterns from original pieces. Many of the items of clothing I use in my show, I have made myself, or I have had made for me specifically to my instructions based on my historic research. The dress I will be using Sunday was made by someone else who has done a lot of research. It's a beautiful dress, and I'm very excited to be able to present it for the first time in this show on Sunday.
So why 1886?
1886, I tend to pick for my clothing programs a year that most distinctly represents a specific silhouette. For example, for some programs, I will represent the year 1861, because that was like the height of the hoop era, in my opinion, with very distinctive features of the dress. Another era I like to represent is 1875, 1876. 1880 and 1881 was another very different silhouette. It was a very skinny silhouette. So I have selected 1886 for this Sunday's performance because it's very typical of the second bustle era. It's a very elegant look. Contrary to what you think, the large horse-shaped bustle actually presents a very elegant silhouette when the dress is fitted very nicely to the woman's body. Plus, because of the display that's happening at the museum right now, they have a number of items of clothing and underwear in their display from the 1880s that I would like to make reference to. So when people see the display, they can actually see it in use of a similar item being put on a real human person in my show. That's why I selected 1886.
And so you're at the New Mexico History Museum, and that's the connection to New Mexico, is
yes,
the exhibit that's there.
Exactly. They invited me to come share this program in connection with their clothing and underwear display. They felt it would be a good living example to bring it to life in front of people, not just to see vintage garments under dim light in a beautiful display like they have, but to see it actually being put on, they can touch it, they can see it, they can feel it, and in some cases, they can actually put it on themselves.
So all of this is this coming Sunday, March 14th at 2 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum. It's called Victorian Dressing from the Inside Out with Sharon Gooley, the historic reenactor. And the exhibit that's there is called Fashioning New Mexico. So, and there will be a free guided tour for that afternoon as well. This event is free with museum admission, and of course, attendance is free on Sundays to all New Mexico residents. Sharon Gooley, thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz will feature Song of the Month, I Got Rhythm.